So should we talk about the Squire of Gothos?
I liked the Squire of Gothos in some ways, and then in some other ways it pissed me off more than I could even begin to talk about.
It's a very slight episode.
I thought it was... It's interesting because Squire of Gothos is the opposite of the Corbomite Renewer, which, as I've said, is so far my favorite episode.
Mm-hmm.
And in both episodes, the crew of the Enterprise are menaced by some superior being who turns out to be, in both cases, a paper tiger. Squire of Gothos turns out to be essentially just a little kid who's, you know, pulling wings off flies, basically. Baylock in...
Or pigtails and inkwells, which I thought was a weird thing to say, since this takes place in this 23rd century, and I doubt anyone is using inkwells. But, you know, the person who wrote the script was probably born in 1920, so...
Aw, that's adorable, you know?
It's probably more accurate back then.
I don't remember what the context of that line was, but I do remember it.
It was at the very end of the episode when they're discussing what happened, and I think Kirk was, you know, saying things like, oh, he was just doing the equivalent of...
Yeah, it's a weird, you know,
childhood pranks.
Putting someone's cyber hair into the computer chip bank.
But, you know, it's always one of those things, right? Like,
yeah.
Well, the way that we, you know, kill ants for fun as children, and, you know, we're so much smarter than ants, and these people are so much smarter than humans. It's like a similar thing.
I always find difficulty with that, because if you are so advanced, do you still have the same parent-child dynamics that, like, humans do? I mean,
I don't know.
It says a lot about this being society that they have, you know, parents and children, and they can scold their kid to come in and, you know, out from playing, you know, and that they can, you know, that they're teaching him to be a better person, you know, to, they're socializing him and teaching. Like, it says a lot about that society.
As opposed to, like, a race of sentient birds who would kick them out of the nest at 5 years old and talk to them again.
Yeah, you know, or, like, we have, you know, a class of females who give birth and then, you know, they're taken to the robot nursery. You know, I've seen those. But in this one, it seems more of a default rather than a conscious world-building choice, of course.
Yeah, I think it's a Star Trek twist ending.
Okay, so let's get to the plot.
The thing about the Squire of Gothos that I think is interesting in light of Shore Leave from last week, it's really kind of the same episode in a lot of ways, because it's just kind of about something going on that they don't really get or really know exactly why this is going on. And in both of these episodes, it's all set up. Like, it's all premise. There's really no plot. And then in the end, of course, you have the denouement, if I can be pretentious.
You can't be. You're not pronouncing it right.
Well, whatever. I'm not French, nor would I want to be. I think the thing about the Squire of Gothos, though, is that the denouement, I'm going to keep saying that now just to annoy you, is that it's actually interesting, whereas the ending of Shore Leave is sort of just hand-wavy, a wizard did it nonsense.
Yeah.
I don't know. What did you think about it?
Well, I thought that there was... what's the guy's name anyway?
Trelane.
Anybody who can out-ham Shatner deserves my respect.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
The season... Because, number one, like, he... The actor, and who, I don't know who that was. I don't know.
I think he was a character actor. Okay. Generally, like, did some things.
He's wonderful to watch in this episode, because the entire time he's when they get onto this planet, and it's, you know, basically looks like a Second Empire drawing room type thing, you know?
Yeah.
And you noticed the suit from the Mantrap episode? Did you notice that?
The salt monster.
That was a nice little in reference that I thought was fun. But
this is what the Star Trek Compendium has to say about Trelane. William Campbell played Trelane. And says he appeared in films such as The High and the Mighty from 1954 and Battle Cry from 1955. And on television, he was a character actor and he did some things. He starred in Cannonball with Paul Birch as a truck driver. So that was the height of his career.
Okay. Well, he's wonderful in this. He just keeps he starts playing off, so he's excited about everything he's doing the entire time. Like, he's menacing these people, but he's having a fucking great time doing it, and he's just, he's horrible. He's this horrible person who's just trapped these people there, but he's just so gleeful that it's really interesting to watch, and I liked that. I liked the performance, and again, anybody who can hold their own for chewing the scenery with Shatner is doing a good job. It's fun to watch.
I'm going to posit something to you.
Okay.
And I'm going to see, just going to lay it out there and see what you think. Is he actually hamming it up?
How do you mean?
Okay. Here's where I'm going with this.
Okay.
At the end of the episode, he completely changes his persona. He becomes a child.
Yes.
Right? And I think the actor pulls that off fairly well.
Oh, yeah. He basically just throws a tantrum because he doesn't want to come outside.
So in the earlier parts of the episode, where Trelane is menacing the crew of the Enterprise, is the actor hamming it up, or is he playing a child who's playing an adult?
Hmm. No, I mean, I understand why he made that choice, but still, as an acting style, it's a very broad acting style. Now, he is playing a child, but I couldn't play a child playing an adult and commit to that degree.
I'm not saying that what he was doing or not, but whether it's accurate or not, there is a judgment there when the use of the word hammy comes into play.
Generally
that sort of that idea that an actor is not very good at what he's doing. You obviously don't feel that way.
Well, see, I use ham, I guess, a little more neutrally, because I would say that for, Shatner and this guy and someone like Ryan Blessed and people like that who are really good actors, they just excel at playing these characters who are so over the top and right. So larger than life. I mean, it's almost – I mean, it takes a good skill to be a ham without being a cheesy ham, because anybody can, be over the top and yes and, and they'll be annoying to watch. To be
improv comedy, for
exactly,
example.
But to be somebody who is playing this, again, this child character, this total id character, and have him be funny and having be almost charming and likable, while you want to see him.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's the
defeated,
thing, right? Like, Trelane is a likable character. He is kind of charming in his own way. A lot of what he's doing, and that may be to the episode's detriment. I don't know, because I don't feel that there's ever a real strong sense that these characters are in danger. Is that he makes you like him, and all of this is just sort of fun and games. Now, he does do things like duel with Captain Kirk with pistols, but
it's one of those.
He doesn't pull it off as being dangerous because he shoots into the ceiling.
But how does Kirk know that he's going to do that? Because Kirk, basically convinces him to duel because he figures out where the power supply is. And, Kirk's plan is to get a gun and shoot the power supply, which he does. But Trelane is like, well, I'm going to shoot first. And Kirk doesn't know that he's going to just shoot into the air, as he ends up doing.
Oh, yeah, Kirk doesn't know that.
Yeah, but that was the one thing that felt false in the story to me. I can definitely accept by this point that Kirk is an extremely brave man, that he's willing to deal with danger if it means getting what he wants.
Which we'll get into in Arena.
Yes, of course. But I don't think Kirk is foolish brave. And, going to somebody, okay, you can shoot me at first at point blank range with that gun is not bravery. That's
but what's
stupidity.
His option there? I mean, just to shoot the thing. I guess in that sense, Kirk was letting him. It was a gamble, right? Because Trelane has showed the ability to disappear any object or any person, before an action can be taken. So in that situation, I don't know that Kirk has many options, because if he tries to ignore Trelane and fires the gun into the mirror, trying to destroy the machine that he thinks might be there, he doesn't even know that it's there. It turns out to be a lucky guess. Trelane might just, magic away his pistol, and then he's got an angry Trelane on his hands, and he doesn't know what he's going to do.
Yeah,
whereas,
of course,
I think Kirk maybe is, yes, Trelane is keeping them there, but I don't think that there's been a strong sense that Trelane is being unfair, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I think that Kirk is sort of, you know, he's making sort of a logical calculation and saying, is this guy really going to shoot me and murder me in cold blood? I don't think so.
Okay. I didn't, and that was one of the those where you got that reading, and I can see that. Yeah. But I mean, either way through the episode, they almost feel like, I don't know, knowing that at the end, Trelane is a kid and most of what he's doing is kind of innocent cruelty. And I think the crew of the Enterprise picks up on that like he can hurt them. He doesn't necessarily want to, but
he never does.
No, but I mean, at one point he grabs a phaser and he's just firing at shit, and it's like,
yeah, but he never hits them.
Guy is unhinged enough. Put it this way, I wouldn't give a crazy person a gun and say, well, he's probably not going to kill me. He's just going to shoot everything. He's just going to do he's going to shoot cans, not me.
Oh yeah, no.
I mean, that's essentially what they did. Again, having no choice. But the fact is, Trelane is such an unknown throughout the episode that I think that's where the threat comes in. Not that he does anything bad or evil or actively hurts them, but the fact that it's so easy for him to do so, that they don't really have to, he doesn't really have to try, and they have to, you know, go about things in such a way that they won't provoke him in a way.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that, and I think, you know, this may be one of those instances where, you know, my prior knowledge of the series is coming into play, because I, of course, know that Trelane is a child and isn't going to hurt them. But, you know, on the other hand, I think you have to look at it in terms of, number one, when he does actually hurt Kirk, when he spirits him out into the toxic atmosphere, and leaves him there for, you know, 5 seconds or whatever it is, and then brings him back. You know, he didn't have to bring him back. Number one, he's interested in Kirk. Number two, I think, is that Trelane says that Earth is his hobby. He's been watching Earth. He's created this entire little bubble of atmosphere in this elaborate drawing room with all of these, you know, things from 19th century Earth there. And he expresses, you know, joy and surprise and happiness at having actual humans there to talk to and to show around his home. And so, yes, he could get angry and kill them all, but then he's left with an empty planet again.
But so you make it seem like that you know, that's to you. You're thinking the two steps ahead, like, if I shoot someone, he'll die and he'll be dead forever. Think about, like, something like in Of Mice and Men. Like, you know, you have the character of George who just, you know, hugs things and, you know, loves them so much and accidentally kills them and doesn't mean to and doesn't necessarily understand the full implications of that. You have, you know, again, back to the thing, you have a kid.
Right, but they don't know. But they don't know he's a kid, so they think that they're dealing with a logical man.
Okay, fair. No, that makes sense. I don't know. I think the episode has some interesting moments. I think the entire scene with Uhura and Yeoman Notrand is hilarious. By the way, which, number one, that scene would have made a lot more sense if it had actually been Rand, because he's
which scene are you talking about?
Okay, so they go back there, they leave the this planet or whatever, they shoot the mirror and they escape, and, you know, they get back to the Enterprise and he's like, aha, no, I'm really here, and, you know, come back. So he takes Uhura and he takes this other yeoman person, and Yoro's just like, he makes all of these really weird comments. This, like, well, you must be a Nubian prize, you know, which love, by the way, the look that she gives Kirk, which is like part offended, part what the fuck? Like, you know, it's one of the, you could tell that this is a terminology that is, because to us that's outdated. So to her, it's even more outdated. And she's just like, you know, hearing a very weird word and, you know, just kind of like, oh, someone's saying that. Okay. But so she's just kind of like sitting at the harpsichord and, you know, he tells her, oh, play some music. And she's like, I can't play, you know, and he gives her the ability to play it. And she's not as weirded out as you would think she would be. She's delighted and she's just getting into it. Now, again, we know you know, Uhura has shown musical talent. You know, she is a musician and, you know, would take delight in that, but she doesn't have as much of the creeped out as I would be if I could suddenly play something I couldn't play before.
Yeah. I think that's something that I actually like that moment for Uhura quite a bit, because I think it does tell you something about her character. Like, she's generally someone who doesn't get afraid that often, and she definitely has a lot of like intellectual curiosity, and she's sort of game for anything.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of shows that.
The most extreme reaction that I've
seen. I think the calmest person in a lot of ways, which, you know, okay, only, in Arena she screams at
that's the most reaction she gets, which is after, you know, all of these stressful things happen and the, you know, there's this, you know, threatening thing and Kirk disappears, like anyone would scream, you know. That's not an unearned reaction from her. But anyway, so he takes this yeoman and he, you know, puts her in this fancy dress, again with the putting women in fancy dresses, and she's, you know, he's dancing with her, and then Kirk gets, after a while, gets upset, and he's like, no, I don't want you wearing his clothes, you know. He gets very jealous, and that scene would have made been so much better if it had been Yeoman Rand saying that about, because that jealousy would have been, that would have been one of those moments where it's like, no, he actually does love her, and, you know, does want to. I feel almost that part was originally written for her.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
I mean, because we're still fairly close to when she left. So I don't remember if it was Shore Leave or the Galileo 7. There was definitely a part there that was changed. It was originally Yeoman Rand, and it was changed.
There was a female yeoman on the
So that, I think that was supposed to be her. And I would not be surprised if the female yeoman in The Squire of Gothos was also originally written as Yeoman Rand.
Yeah, I mean, there's enough reason where he's just like, all right, let's stop fucking around. This is a bad guy. Let's not be friends with the bad guy, you know. But again, it would have had that extra dimension. But
There's a couple of, I think, nice things about this episode in terms of building the world, because I think the show is getting a little more comfortable with itself. There's one nice scene where they all get transported back to the ship, and a crewman immediately appears to the side of Kirk with a status report, and Kirk signs off on it. It's just little things like that they're starting to do now to sort of make it an attention to detail that this is like a working military ship, and that, yes, he's been away for a while, so he needs to sign off on this report. Like, I like that little
moment. I mean, I remember that I read somewhere that they'd rigged up the set so that way, like, everybody's console had like some, like, a button and a light, and when you pushed it, it would send the light to another person, so you'd see that one. So there was always, you know, so it created this fake work for people to do. So what, you know, helped with the background stuff where you're actually like typing something, or, you know, pretending to do something, or they're reacting to something as they would in real life.
Right, right.
Which is a very clever thing.
The entire set, I think, is a masterful piece of design.
Now that they've figured it out. Yeah, I mean, I remember in the original, the bridge in the original pilot, and in Where No Man Has Gone Before, were awful.
But, yeah, yeah.
I just wish I could have seen. So I'm watching this on Netflix, and on Netflix they have the enhanced version, and it looks like shit, because you have these great 60s sets, you know, that are practical, built and constructed, and these parts that they, you know, made out of stuff from the Five and Dime, and, you know, just these really clever things, and then you have this shitty looking CG of the Enterprise. I have no. I find practical effects charming. I've never found charming CG effects.
I don't necessarily disagree with you. I think in terms of the CGI, and this might be a good opportunity to talk about it a little bit. Yes, the enhanced versions of the original Star Trek, as they call them, were in the works for a few years, and they were rolled out.
Yeah.
On the Blu-ray, you have the option of watching either the enhanced effect or the original. The reason they did this is two reasons. Number one, a lot of the footage was in very poor condition. And number two, and I think the more important reason, is that the effects just would not look good in HD. Like, they would have looked like models. And that was a more You could say that that's a questionable decision or not. I don't necessarily agree or disagree. I don't have much of an opinion about it, mostly because they made both available on the Blu-ray.
Yeah, I don't have that. I love the cheesy Harryhausen type shit. Like, I love, you know, when you have like the monster and it's really just obvious claymation. But there's,
well, they didn't take that stuff out.
Oh, I know. But there's a sense of, again, when you see the ship going through, I think it's just so more of an accomplishment when you figure out how to do it with, you know, erasing frame by frame and, you know, having these models on wires and things that people actually built. I mean, when you have something in CG, I'm not knocking the talent of graphic, or, you know, of computer artists and all of that. I know that's way beyond my ability and I know it takes a lot of, you know, work to do, but it's, I don't know. Maybe it's just, it's a personal aesthetic for me. A lot of things. It looks, I mean, I guess it just looks too video gamey.
They could have put more money into the CG for the original original series. The CG for the later shows, especially Enterprise, looks a lot better because the budget was higher.
Also, it was, and, I'm sure, closer to when CG started. So, you know,
no, it was around the same time. Mm. I mean, they did the enhanced effects in like 2005. No, 2006.
I'm sorry. I mean the show originally aired when CG was, you know, around and existing, and then so forth.
There was no CG when the original Star Trek. What are you talking
Enterprise.
About?
Enterprise. We're talking about Enterprise. When was Enterprise?
2001.
Yeah, 2001, there was computer graphics. You know, Babylon 5 had happened, and that had all that CG.
Which so looks terrible.
But oddly enough, when I'm watching Babylon 5, I find the CG bits kind of charming.
Yeah, maybe.
I feel like it's the best they could do with the technology and the time, and God love them, they did it. You know,
well, we could. And this is not a Babylon Five show, so I'm not going to get into it. But
it's also very jarring because every time they show a shot of this Enterprise, it's this completely newly redone CG thing, and then you go, it's not subtle at all. It looks like from a completely different show.
I guess I'm not sure what you're saying then, because you're saying that Enterprise was closer to when CG happened.
Yeah, so I'm saying, having computer graphics in Enterprise is less of an anachronism than having computer graphics for a show from 2001 is not an anachronism.
I understand.
Having it from a 1967 show, it looks very anachronistic. I guess that's what jars me.
I can understand that. Yeah, I mean, the one thing that I don't like about the CG effects in the enhanced Star Trek is the fact that the Enterprise, yeah, it does look a little too shiny and a little too video gamey. I actually like most of the enhanced effects quite a bit in terms of the planets, the things on the view screen,
and that's,
In terms of like the phaser shots, they fixed a few things. They fired the phasers at one point and photon torpedoes came out, or vice versa. I don't remember what, you know, things like that where they fixed them. And there was some controversy about those changes.
Oh no, I'm sure it's one of those things I would never notice, but
it's certainly nothing like what George Lucas has done with the Star Wars franchise, for example.
And I have to,
But yeah, I can understand that, and I think if you had the option to watch the original, this wouldn't be a problem. And that's why I don't think it's a problem, because it's available to me on the Blu-ray. Most people that are watching Star Trek that are not huge fans, that are just watching it on Netflix, probably aren't going to care. And people that are going to own it on Blu-ray are huge fans that are going to care. So I think the subset of people that are going to care, it might even be just you.
Yeah, and this might not even be the only reason I'm watching it this closely is because of this podcast. Yeah. And I have to say, it's mostly the Enterprise scenes. Galileo 7 had a lot of space scenes that looked shitty because they were CG, and I really would have liked to have seen the original on that. But
I actually like the model work in the Galileo 7.
Yeah.
When they're launching the shuttle quite a bit. I don't like
it was a CG docking bay in the enhanced.
Because one of the things that they talked about doing with the enhanced editions of the show was very closely matching what they were doing in the model shots. And I think a lot of times they didn't do that. Like, I'll show you later on. I'll show you the scene from the Galileo 7, and you can see how different it is.
Because I also know this is the first time, you know, we've mentioned this, and when we saw a Corbomite maneuver, You showed me the bit where, like, the Rubik's Cube is attacking them, and it did look much better in the enhanced there. It looked very blurry in the original. Stuff like that, I felt, yes, it did improve. But when you, and when you're doing little insets or, you know, again, phaser shots or whatever, that's better. But when you're just completely replacing for, you know, to show the computery thing of the thing, that, I guess,
well, that's not why they did it. They did
I know, because they wanted to be, I mean, I guess it had something to do with the, this is how it should have looked when, you know, if we had had computer graphics in the 60s, this, we would have done it, you know?
Yeah. And I think I'll say one more thing about this, yeah, and we'll move on.
This rabbit hole.
I think, you know, with the model shots of the Enterprise being replaced by CG, I think you could make a strong argument for saying that the model shots of the Enterprise were the ones that had the highest budget. They had the most time put into the model, and they had, you know, the most detailed model. And so that probably would have looked okay in HD, and perhaps they should have left that alone.
Yeah.
But we'll never know.
Anyway, there's one final point that makes me absolutely hate this episode, and it's the fact that they're energy beings. And I basically, I mean, that's what this,
I don't know if we do know that they're energy,
I mean,
beings.
That's what it's, I'm sorry, I see a shiny thing, I say that, you know, normal scans show no life, you know, but there's a thing there, you know, and you know, it can do things. Well, that says energy beings to me.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I kind of feel like that's just kind of one of those things that, you know, they may be energy beings, or they may just, that just might be how they communicate over long distances. We don't know.
I hate energy beings so much that I don't care. This episode sucks because it implies energy beings.
That's fair.
I don't know why it is. I am totally racist against energy beings. Anytime a sci-fi brings that out, I see red.
No, we've talked about this before. Yeah. It's a stupid concept.
I know. So therefore, this episode gets negative 1 million tribbles.
All right.
If it had not had energy beings, it would be a 7 out of 10.
Well, there is a couple things that I would like to...
Oh, we're not at triples yet.
No.
Oh,
we're
I'm
not.
Sorry.
Don't jump ahead to triples.
I feel like we were on triples.
No, we're not
on triples.
All
right, well then, everybody forget my score. It'll be a surprise.
Just one thing I wanted to bring up about the show, about this particular episode, where they talk about how he's had like this 900-year lag that he didn't account for in looking through his telescope or whatever. Interestingly enough, if that were the case, Star Trek would have been taking place in about the 28th century, which it does not take place in the 28th century. So that's just one of those little things where they still weren't sure exactly when this was taking place.
Wait, when? Yeah, I would say, what's the general accepted? Because, I mean, 900 years from 1967 when this was aired was around 1060, 1067, Norman Conquest.
He mentioned Napoleon.
Yes. Yeah,
so this would have been the 19th century.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. You're the history guy.
No, I'm just saying that would be when it was set.
It's interesting because,
and it's not set then, it's set in the 23rd century. So
the writers are making mistakes. They're fallible.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, I was wondering that, but I didn't really.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't establish. I don't think they definitively established when the show took place for a while. I don't even know if they ever did in the original series at all. I don't know if they ever gave like an Earth calendar date for anything that happened.
And that, of course, makes, you know, no matter what, that makes 20th century references even more dated, because how often do we make reference to stuff that happened, you know, the pop culture events of, you know, the 1100s?
Not often.
Yeah. I don't even know what the running gags were in, you know, 1100. I know there were, because people have always had memes, but, you know, I'm sure that there were irritating people making the equivalent of lolcats in the 1100s.
Speaking of memes, why is, and I believe it's pronounced tally-ho, not a meme? Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I don't know how I forgot about that scene, but it was wonderful. Like,
greetings and felicitations.
And yeah, like this old English looking script. Like he apparently studied on, you know, Earth fonts. And
apparently,
everything.
Yeah. He had a Mac, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I'll give this a 6. It's a slight episode. There's not a lot to it, but it's charming. I like the twist, and I think there's some nice interactions among the main cast in this one.
Yeah, and I give a full extra point. 7 tribbles for William Campbell's performance.
All right.
I liked it that much.
Well, let's move on to Arena then.
Okay. Let's move on to Arena.
What did you think about Arena?
Well, when you talk about having... We've talked about several episodes. And we're like, yeah, do the stakes feel real? Do they feel, you know... Do they feel like they're in danger? Does it feel like something... Well, there's about... At the beginning of Arena, there's about 30 seconds like, boy, we're going to have a great... Oh, shit! It's destroyed! And, like, from then on, the entire episode is just trying to escape death.
So you bought into this one?
Immediately.
Good. Okay.
It feels very... And what I loved about it was the scope of the episode is huge. First of all, they have this... Sorry?
I was going to say... before anything else, let's frame this episode by saying that we finally have our first mention of the Federation.
Yes, when he, because he mentions that somebody, like, you know, if someone from the, you know, someone finds this, send this to the Federation or
right,
whatever.
Right, and then they'll be up. There's the scene in Kirk's quarters with Spock where they're talking about what Kirk is going to do when they're chasing the Gorn ship. And he says, yes, well, this would be war with the Federation, like that, yeah. You know. And so we now know what the government is or what the country is or whatever it is.
Or at least what it's called.
There's not much more to say about it for this episode, but I want to just put that right at the beginning of the conversation because I think that's an important thing to keep in mind as we talk about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's at this point, acts as a generic EarthGov, basically, you know, or just whatever humanity's, you know, concern is. But, yeah, so first of all, they're on this colony that's been destroyed. And
Cestus 3.
Yeah, and they're being shot at, and, you know, all this shit's going down, and they're trying to figure out what happened. So, I mean, I have to say, I felt like the individual segments went on a little too long. I thought there were there's one too many shot of Kirk rolling around in the dust, you know?
But he's good at it.
Oh, no, it's wonderful.
I wrote in my notes that... Nimoy is nowhere near as good at rolling around in the dirt as Shatner is because there's a scene where Spock runs after Kirk and I think maybe Nimoy fell down. I'm not sure, but yeah.
Well, Nimoy was too respectable for that shit, you know?
Yeah, probably.
Nimoy's the respectable one. Anyway, so they have this segment, then there's this chase where they're chasing this other ship, and, you know, how much warp can we go without blowing up, you know, and then they have this scene where they're on this planet, and, you know, he and this lizard are attacking each other, and it's like, so there's very three distinct set pieces, and, you know, not counting connecting bits in the beginning and ending, each of are very high stakes, and each of which the stakes get higher even.
Yeah, what did you think about the chase sequence? Because, you know, there's really been no explicit talk of speeds or what they can do or what they can't do. There's been sort of like this general warp impulse, you know, sublight, blah, blah. They don't really ever... And so this was the first episode which sort of... you know, put forth this notion that the ship has some sort of theoretical max speed and that they can push past that, but it's very dangerous to do so.
I mean, the implication I got from that scene was that warp is the speed of light or very close to, and warp 2 is twice the speed of light, warp 3 three times, and so on.
You are very close, actually.
Because they mentioned it's warp 1, now it's sublight.
I believe it's a logarithmic scale, not an absolute or whatever. I'm not a mathematician.
Nobody understands what logarithms are. But.
So it's not like it's not 3 is 3 times 4 is 4 times. It's you know, it increases exponentially, I want to
say.
But I could go pull out my next generation technical manual if I really wanted to. It explains warp speed, but
I mean, it doesn't matter. I'm not, you know, going really. To do that. It's just there's, you know, warp speed is fine, and, you know, maybe getting like warp 3, warp 4 is, you know, it's going very fast, but, you know, the Enterprise can handle. And then when it's getting to like 6 or 7, it's, you know, like getting when you're just, you know, putting your car to the floor, and, you know, and the engine's starting to overheat. Like, you know, that's all that scene mattered. But my one question is, so they're chasing this, and, like, they're at warp 3, and, you know, so they're like, okay, go to warp 4. Oh, they're on warp 4. Well, we'll go to warp 5. You know, and when Kirk is prepared to go to past warp 8, which, you know, everybody is like, that's a really bad idea. We can't do that for very long. You know?
Yeah, I like that one look when he gives the command to go to warp 8 that Scotty kind of goes, what the hell? Like, okay. He doesn't say anything. He just gives this look like, I just shit my pants.
Yeah. And Kirk says that order so matter-of-factly that you know that he is prepared. When he was, you know, starting at Warp 5, he was prepared for the Warp 8 eventuality.
And he's prepared to blow the ship up, apparently.
So why didn't he just start, like, when they were at Warp 4, he goes to Warp 6, overtakes them, you know, only a little pushes the ship, because he wants to chase these guys. Like, I don't get why they, you know, didn't do that.
Yeah, I don't know
besides
why either.
Besides just, you know, like, yes, it's a much more dramatic scene this way, but, you know, be that's practical, probably why. You know?
There is some writerly stuff that's going on in this episode. I appreciate that you think that the stakes are high throughout the whole episode, and you really did feel the danger.
And
because I do think they did a good job with it. But the one thing that I don't like about the episode, there's two things I don't like about it. Number one is I feel like the ship also being attacked by the Gorn ship. It doesn't really go anywhere when Kirk and Spock are trapped on the planet, and it just feels like that's a plot device to keep them on the planet so they can get blown up for a little while.
Yeah, no.
And the other thing I don't like about the episode is, you know, the third set piece when Kirk and the Gorn captain are fighting on this asteroid. I think it drags a little bit, but on the whole, I really like this episode.
Now, I know this episode is based on a short story, I believe.
Yes, it is.
Now, there's a lot of narration in this episode. Kirk is basically saying, you know, and then we went onto the planet, and I saw the lizard, and my reptilian, my fear of the reptiles. And was that taken from the story? Because it seems almost like this is much more, you know, we have the captain's log at the beginning and most of the time in the middle, but this is throughout.
I don't know, actually. The short story was also called Arena, and I've never read it, so yeah. I don't know anything about it, really. It actually was also adapted into a Twilight Zone episode.
Oh.
Yeah, so I feel like maybe they did put some extra stuff in there because, of course, the Twilight Zone was only half hour and Star
Trek
is an hour.
Yeah, it feels like they added that, you know, like maybe in the short story he was on the planet for like 5 minutes and they, you know, saw the ship taking off and, you know, followed it. And, you know,
yeah,
that's where that, and that's,
yeah.
And that would be fine. It's just, you know, with this, you know, second and third set piece only took so long. Like, it feels like a filler bit. It's an exciting filler bit, but, you know.
No, I agree with you. I think it does feel a little bit like filler, but, you know, there's not a lot of fat in the episode, really. I mean, on the whole, I think it works really well.
Now, the other week I said that, and which episode was this on, where Galileo 7, where Spock says he doesn't want to kill these creatures because of his respect for life. And here, they're chasing the ship, and Spock says, you know, to Kirk, I really don't think we should just attack them, you know. And he starts to say, you know, because of my respect, and Kirk basically says, no, you know, we're doing this, you know. This
respect for sentience, actually, is what
sorry,
it says.
Sentient life. Sorry, that's how I meant, what I meant. That's what I said, and you can't prove otherwise.
What I can go back to the tape is what I can
but
do.
But then we'd have to stop recording, and I would get bored. And
fine.
Also, it's not a tape. It's a file.
Yes, yes, yes.
So, yeah, I think that's another. Spock does not, again, view humans as special. He does not view any particular species as better than anybody else.
No, he doesn't, no.
And which is part of the theme of the episode. As it turns out, the conflict between the humans and the Gorn has to do with the fact that the Gorn believe this to be one of their planets and that humanity has invaded, and they're basically performing a counterstrike. So humanity shot first is what they're saying. And, you know,
which I find kind of strange because it's basically a peaceful settlement that anybody can come trade at, and, you know, are the Gorn justified in destroying it? Yes, probably, because I think if Canada decided that what they really needed to do was build a suburb of Toronto in Michigan, we'd probably have a problem with that. But at the same time, it feels a little, you know, it feels a little too crazy to me. Like, yeah, okay, so you didn't try and talk to them first? Like, what?
Ants come into your apartment and you don't just immediately throw down an ant trap and kill the entire...
But there's
the thing that says kills the queen, kills the colony.
Right.
How do the Gorn don't really... But how do the Gorn necessarily know that humanity is at their level of intelligence? They may think of themselves, or, you know, they may have a part of their culture where they view this as untouchable. You know, the Gorn may not realize that humanity doesn't know, you know, don't touch that planet. You know,
I don't really buy that. I mean, because yeah, it doesn't really jive with like how Star Trek evolves.
Of course, and I'm kind of casting for an explanation to fit the facts.
One of the things that I think Star Trek kind of gets away from mostly is this idea of much more powerful civilizations, technologically older civilizations that have been around much longer than the races of the Federation. Mostly because I think Star Trek did so many of these iconic episodes in the original series that it's hard. Number one, it's hard to do them. And number two, it's, you know, once you do a couple of them, it's kind of a plot structure that's not all that dramatically interesting, because what can you really do with it? So, you know, it sounds kind of funny to talk about realism in terms of Star Trek,
yeah,
the franchise, but I guess I can kind of see that. But at the same time, the technology of the Gorn and the Federation is seen as fairly on parity. I don't know. I mean, and the Gorn don't seem they don't seem super warlike. I mean, the captain is taunting Kirk and he says he's going to be merciful and things like that. But I don't really get the sense that
merciful
the Gorn likes this, or he likes doing this. And at the end of the episode, the implication is that the Gorn and the Federation are going to send diplomats and they're going to kind of try and hash this out.
Yeah, but at the same time, I don't think the line that, you know, you saved your opponent's life when he certainly would have killed you. I don't think that line is necessarily.
How do they know that? They thought both of them were savages. It's quite possible that the Gorn, you know, once
is the same as Kirk.
Once had Captain Kirk on the ground and he saw his face, would have done the same thing that Kirk did.
Yeah, and again,
The Metrons are kind of like assuming dicks, really.
Yeah.
They don't know what the hell's going on any more than the Federation or the Gorn do.
Okay, so this is something that
they're bullies, kind of.
This is something that, well, they think of themselves. See, I don't think of them as bullies.
I
don't like the Metrons. But I, by the way, we are the Metrons as the beginning of every transmission. That should be a meme.
Yeah, we are the Metrons. We are so much better than you.
I mean, like, that's how like you begin.
Listen to us speak.
It's going to be the beginning of their album. You know, they just scream out, "We're the Metrons! Hey, hey!" You know. Metron music sucks. They see this conflict, and they're basically the ultimate patriarchy in a way. They say, well, they're doing kind of the equivalent of, you know, well, you smoke one cigarette, we're going to make you smoke an entire pack, you know. They're saying, well, you want to kill each other? Fine! We're going to give you a place, and you can kill each other. Fucking do it! Oh, by the way, you know, don't worry about, you know, destroying the other ship. We're going to do that for you. Like, it's the ultimate and logical endpoint of where any conflict lies. Two leaders using their armies to fight each other, or their ships, or their resources. Well, we're just going to make the two leaders themselves fight, you know, to the death.
Yeah.
And we're going to make the, because that was originally what the plan was. Whoever shot the other ship first would have destroyed the other ship. So by making it, you know, okay, well, you know, one captain kills the other, well, we'll destroy the rest of that captain ship. It's just a more personal version of what they were doing anyway.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, Kirk would not have shown mercy at all, because he has, during the chase, he has his opponent cornered, he thinks. And he's ready to just, okay, well, we're going to get to firing range and we're going to kill them. And that's what you're going to do. And he is not at that point going to show mercy at all. He is not going to listen to the Gorn. He's not going to talk to him. He's not going to figure out what's going on. It's only when seeing a personal face really on it that, and, you know, realizing that this guy is in the exact, this is me, this is the exact same person, in a way, a balance of terror kind of situation, except not as explicit, because they kept, you know, harping on that in Balance of Terror. I don't know. I think the Metron's punishment is interesting, and I think they're cops, basically.
Yeah, well, they're kind of cops, but not really, because they're not on patrol. I mean, they're sort of like waiting for people. I mean, it's kind of like if the police just sort of patrolled, you know, one block. And if you came in their block, they said, "No, you can't be here. This is our block." They're not cops. They're a gang.
Fair. well, what's the difference, man? Come on, you know.
Ron Paul 2012. The other thing I think about, you know, what Kirk is doing on the planet specifically is, I think there's kind of an implication there that Kirk is using his wits to win, whereas the Gorn is using its, you know, intimidating, you know, strength, because, you know, he's throwing huge rocks at Kirk, and, you know, Kirk crushes him with a rock and he doesn't die, and he's running around with a knife, whereas Kirk is running around, you know, finding coal and diamonds and sulfur to make a cannon.
I loved that part because it's when Star Trek turned into a Sierra adventure game. And you could, like, but you could totally, like, exactly see how the scene would play out. Like, I could picture even the graphics, and, like, you click Kirk, you know, and it's like, when you're looking at stuff, you have Spock narrating stuff, you know, instead of a narrator. But, like, every so often, like, there's a random chance of the Gorn appearing. You have to click to the other side of the screen while, like, the scary music plays.
Yeah.
So I thought that was funny. It was because I've played that level so many times in games.
What did you think of the sort of narrative device of having the bridge crew watching Kirk in his struggle?
Well,
did that work for you?
This reminds me of Galileo 7 and also of the last one, we just watched, Squire of Gothos, in the way in that you have a crew on the bridge and you have someone in a situation and they can't directly interact with each other, but the one is trying to help the other. And in Galileo 7, so they have this deadline, and Kirk is basically trying to do whatever he can, and he's stalling as much as possible, and he's doing all these things. And, you know, he has no options, but he's just kind of, like, making options out of thin air. And you have in Squire of Gothos, they're just scanning the planet, and they find this one tiny patch, and they're just trying, you know, they figure this is the only shot we, you know. They're doing desperately. In this, you know, Spock says, "Welp, he's somewhere. I give up." But the point is, there's nothing they can really do but watch.
It kind of heightens their helplessness then, in a way.
Yes. And I think it also gives a bit more of a, because they have Kirk narrating his things through the device of this recording device. And, you know, that's fine, but I think also it would be really irritating for Kirk to say, "I found some sulfur. Oh, maybe I can make this out of this." And, you know, so having Kirk does that kind of mitigates it. I hate how clever Spock is being. Again, that's more of a, that makes it feel more like an adventure game because it's not really giving you the solution to the puzzle. Like, you know, you would think that it would make more sense logically for him to say, you know, this saltpeter, whatever. It's like, oh, he could totally make dynamite out of that. All he needs is this, this, and this. You know, again, for the audience's benefit, they don't want to know the plan right away.
It's a proxy audience, right?
Yeah,
that's number one. And number two is it does, like you said, it does allow for the show to explain things in perhaps a more organic fashion than, you know, having Kirk say, "Oh, here's some sulfur. I'm going to make a cannon now." Blah, you know, or just having him run around the planet and having 5 minutes without any dialogue whatsoever. Star Trek was sort of experimental in some ways, but Andy Warhol was not working for the show, so that probably would not have
flopped. Wasn't that the whole point of, wasn't the start for Star Trek movie basically Empire, but with starships? I do know that if they had a woman on this planet, there would be like a 10-minute scene of her playing with the diamonds, though. I mean, she wouldn't do anything. She would just go into rapture.
Yeah.
Well, Ruby, one of the things which offends me about this episode, and this is a, because I've seen this theme of, you know, an advanced civilization suddenly surprised by one of humanity's noble qualities. So this is the Metrons. scan the ship, and they know enough about humanity to know that it is a bloodthirsty conquest species, which I won't say that we aren't. We certainly have that in our history. But they weren't able to find a single instance of mercy or nobility or compassion or anything in at all in their scan. I mean, that's... They couldn't find a single book on the Enterprise that had that as the ending. They couldn't find a single moment of, you know, beauty. They didn't even get a little recording of Uhura singing or something like that. They, like, that bothers me because it's such an incomplete picture and they don't, you know, again, to be so surprised that this comes from them, you know, well, what the fuck were you looking at?
Maybe they're incompetent.
Well, they obviously.
I mean, isn't that like one thing that the powerful sort of, you know, assume that everyone below them is worse than them?
Of course.
So they could have just
everybody assumes that anybody below.
They could have just been doing a cursory scan to you know, confirm their suspicions.
Maybe.
They could have not done it at all and were just saying that they did it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Uhura is specifically saying we're being scanned. It's a very, you know, and she's talking about this scan and how it's happening. So the implication.
Who's to say that they can't make it look like they're doing a scan, but they're not really? I mean, I don't know.
That seems a little.
What is the point of Eric? What is the point of what they're doing in general?
Eric,
I mean, it's the Metrons.
If it's not on screen, it's not canon.
Yes, I know.
They are the Metrons.
No, Kirk made the canon later.
Oh, at the end. Yeah. I liked the episode very much. I know this is one of those classic Star Trek episodes.
It is.
And I know why exactly it is.
Yeah. It's a good one.
I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but I liked it.
It's definitely a good one. One thing I want to mention, and I tend to try and make this like an ongoing thing with this show, is the premise that defensive screens or shields, as they will come to be known as, you can't transport through them. That is something that stays consistent throughout pretty much all of Star Trek, and this is the first time that was brought up.
Okay.
So that's one thing to watch out for.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing I want to say, just piggybacking on the CGI conversation that we had earlier, I don't know if you mentioned, but when you first see the Gorn in this episode, he blinks once.
That
was done for the CGI, and I hate it. Like, okay. I just hate it. Like, it serves no purpose except like, hey, look, we can make the Gorn blink. But they do it once, and they never do it again.
And it's one of those.
So things, why do it at all?
And
it just brings attention to itself needlessly and serves no purpose.
Because he very obviously is a guy in a suit the entire time. And there is no attempt to, you know, it's not like you say, oh, well, he blinks, so he's really real. Like, I don't think of it, you know, that didn't create the illusion. Yeah.
No, I don't know why they did that. It's just one of those CGI things that it bothers me. But anyway.
But again, talk about charming. I thought it was adorable that Kirk is wrestling with a dude in a rubber suit.
Yeah.
Like, that is so much more. It's more fun to watch than it would have been if he had just fought a CG thing. Because it's number one, more visceral in a way, because they are actually having this, you know, fight, even though it's very lackadaisical. Like, it's one of the laziest fights I've ever seen.
Well, there's a justification for that,
oh, yeah.
Of course, because the Gorn is cold blooded, and they do say that he does move slower. He doesn't have as much agility, but he's stronger, so there we go.
Still, you know, it's one of those, I would rather see something interesting than something technically well done.
That's fair. So how many tribbles would you give this episode?
I'd give the same, a 7 tribble episode.
Yeah, I'll give it 7 as well. I like it better than Squire of Gothos because it's generally a more well-constructed episode. And there's more to it, I think.
Yeah.
But it's not the best, but it's pretty good.
Again, if it had been cut to a half hour or so, I think it would have been a lot stronger.
Yeah, yeah. Good. All right. Well, next week we have Tomorrow is Yesterday and Court Martial for you.
Okay.
So get ready for that.
I don't know either of those episodes.
I do.
Oh, well, obviously you do because you've seen the show like 30 times. This is like your 31st time through it.
Yeah, I've seen it one time every year since I was born.
No, you haven't. You started when you were 20. You watch it like every couple weeks.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
Either one of those could be right. We don't know. All right, well, yeah, we'll see you then.
Yeah.